What is sexual intimacy? It's a really difficult question to ask, really difficult question to answer. Is it just sexual intercourse? Or is it something way before that? Could it be an erotic glance? Is it oral sex? Could it be a kiss? What is sexual intimacy?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
We're continuing our program on biblical sexual ethics. And it sounds like from the discussion we had prior to beginning taping that this is going to be a pretty lively one. Jack has a lot of things on his mind today regarding sexual ethics and the climate today. And let's get going on it then, Jack.
Okay. What I'm going to suggest is that there are five what we might call cardinal virtues of sexual ethics. And what I mean by that is that if we put the whole picture of sexuality that the Bible presents together, I should say the Bible and our common sense in combination with one another, the picture that that creates for us recommends to us kind of five different cardinal virtues. And I thought maybe we could talk about them one at a time. Some of them we've already talked about in the context of marriage, but there are different facets of them that I think are deserving of more discussion. The first one is monogamous faithfulness.
Now, you're calling these cardinal virtues?
You can talk me out of it if you want to.
Well, will you define that? And then maybe I'll talk you out of it.
Just the top five things to keep in mind about what's right about about the way we employ our sexuality. These are the things that we need to answer to. These are the things we need to seek to emulate in our use of our sexuality. The first one is monogamous faithfulness. What I mean by that is, in the context of a marriage between one man and one woman, being sexually faithful to one another, that is, not employing sexuality in any other context other than in the intimate relationship between the husband and wife. They don't have sex with anybody else other than one another.
So, Jack, immediately when you say they don't have sex with anyone else, I think we need to drop back and say, what is sex? I think that's a very contested issue today. Lots of people don't know what that means. Does it just mean sexual intercourse, or is it something far before we enter into intercourse with another person?
Right. Yeah, as we sit here producing this program, there's a controversy in our society. The President of the United States has been alleged to have had a sexual encounter with a young intern in the White House. Part of the debate that is swirling around that is whether or not it is a sexual encounter, because one of the ideas that's floated out there is that it wasn't sexual intercourse in the normal sense. I think they're alleging that it was perhaps oral sex, and for that reason, it's not really an adulterous relationship and perhaps not even a sexual relationship. I don't know who the sources are of all that information, but it really doesn't make any difference. The point is, somebody somewhere is raising the question, what exactly constitutes sexual intimacy such that that kind of relationship outside of marriage would be wrong, would be inappropriate. Let me back up for a second and imagine, let's imagine that someone is making the defense. And I was in a counseling situation once where exactly this sort of defense was being made to me. Let's say that someone was making the defense that because I'm having oral sex with a woman who's not my wife, I'm not committing adultery because it's not intercourse. The reasoning might go something like this. that the thing that's wrong about adultery is you might have children by that other woman. Since you're not going to have children through oral sex, therefore, that's not wrong. Ultimately, what we consider to be wrong about our actions is ultimately going to arise out of what our understanding of the purpose of sexuality is, and what purposes are at cross purposes, or what actions are at cross purposes to what God intended our sexuality to be. If the purpose of sexuality is to have children, and God wants us to have children only in the context of marriage, then
that argument makes sense.
That argument makes sense, exactly. So that's why all the time that we spent on this theory of sexuality becomes really crucial, because
this time that we spent, not today, but in previous programs.
In previous programs, exactly. What we have been discussing in previous programs is that the purpose of sexuality is, in the final analysis, to be a kind of language. That any kind of act of intimacy communicates to the other person a degree of commitment and involvement and oneness with the other person that is appropriate to communicate to someone if I am married to them and I'm prepared to become one with them in the rest of my life. And it's an inappropriate message to send to them if I'm not intending to follow through and become one with them in the rest of my life. So the thing that's wrong about adultery is twofold. One, I am lying to the adulterer or adulteress with whom I am having the affair. I'm lying to them because I'm making a claim to them. I'm sending a message to them with my body, with my intimacy. I'm sending a message to them that they are special to me, that they are particularly important to me, and that my life is theirs. I'm giving my life to them, which is a false message. If I intend to be married to my wife, then I can't very well be saying with my body, I really want to give my life to you. That's one problem. The other problem is, I have said, not only with my marriage vows, but also with my body, presumably, to my wife, that I am giving my life to you. I am therefore lying to her if, on the other hand, I'm willing to turn, or at least if I'm not lying to her. I think some adulterers would say, no, I really am giving my life to my wife. I really am committed to her. I really do love her. This thing over here, this affair, is nothing. It doesn't mean anything. It's just sex. The problem with that is, if that's true, if that's just sex, then what's happening between the man and his wife? He's, at the very minimum, he's trivializing the intimacy that he's having with his wife then. And that's wrong. It's wrong to take what God has given us and trivialize it. It's not inherently trivial to have sex with someone. It's inherently meaningful. So on both counts, I'm cheating on my wife, and I'm lying to the man or woman that I'm having an affair with. That's the case whether we're talking about normal intercourse or any other sort of erotic encounter. It really doesn't make any difference. It's the erotic nature of the encounter itself, that is, the intimate nature of the encounter itself, that makes it inappropriate outside the context of marriage, pure and simple.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us, by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
Jack, let me see if I can summarize what you were telling us just prior to the break. You told us a lot. It's quite a mouthful, so let me see if I caught it.
Okay.
You were saying that we can't decide what is sexual intimacy apart from understanding the purpose of sexual intimacy. The purpose of sexual intimacy in our culture is quite different than the biblical understanding of it. In our cultural, sexual intimacy is just for pleasure. It's just something we do because we like to. It just is kind of an addition to our life that's pretty nice. But biblical sexual ethics talks about something very, very different than that. The Bible says that, or leads us to understand, doesn't really say explicitly, but leads us to understand that sexual intimacy is just does have meaning. It does mean that I am saying to somebody else that I'm sexually intimate with that I am committed to you, that I'm being loyal to you, that I'm making with my body as well as my vow in my marriage a commitment to you that says I will be your lifelong partner exclusively. If I don't do that, if I have a sexual, erotic relationship with another person, I am both lying to them because I'm not really committed to them, and I am also lying to my spouse because I'm saying with other ways that I'm committed to them, and yet I really am not.
Right.
That's a pretty good summary of that.
Right. Let me explore that last point just a little bit. On the street, at least up until recent times at least, we described adultery as cheating on your wife or cheating on your husband. I think that's a very apt phrase. It really gets at the heart of the violation that adultery is. Because, as we've discussed in prior programs, the psychological need that gets met by marriage, the psychological satisfaction and reward that we experience in marriage, is that idea that I am unique and special and the most important person in another person's life. I may not be the most important person in the universe, but at least I'm the most important person in the sphere of that person's life. And everything they have said is to say that to me, and that's what they've promised to me in their marriage vows. Monogamy, faithful monogamy, is one of the most dramatic ways that we can send that message to the other person. I will give my body to you and only you. I will not give my body to anyone else. There's nothing else in our lives that we can righteously withhold from my neighbor. I understand what I'm saying here. I mean, given the right set of circumstances, God may be calling upon me to give of my time to my neighbor, or to give of my money to my neighbor, or to give of my energy to my neighbor, or to give my attention to my neighbor. Love may require that of me, the love that God commands of all of us. But never does God ever require of me, give your body to your neighbor. Because it's only a message that I'm sending. It's nothing ultimately of any substance. And that's what's important to see. I can withhold that righteously from other people because all I'm saying is I'm ratifying my marriage vows to somebody. And I'm never required to be married to anybody other than the person I'm married to. So I don't have to sleep with my neighbor. If I do, then I'm taking away the only thing that God has given me to use to communicate to my wife or my husband, you are absolutely the most unique person in my life. You're the most special person in my life. And I'm giving that away. And we feel, if we are the victim of adultery, we feel cheated by that. Because now no longer does sex mean you are the most important person in my life. Apparently, you're willing to give your body away to whoever you want to. So where is this message? Where is this statement that you're to make to me, that I am unique, that I am the only person in your life? Where is that message?
You use the word, I feel cheated, that we feel cheated when our spouse goes out and has an affair with another person. I think another word that's even stronger is we feel betrayed.
Yeah.
And it's a trauma of betrayal. Because it isn't just that God is giving us a rule that says you need to do this or not do this, and he's taking something away from us by saying be monogamous. He's giving something to us. He's saying what he's giving to us is the opportunity to have what our hearts, what our souls long for, what our psyche longs for more than anything else. And that is to be a valued, special, important person. And to have that in the context of marriage is such a gift. To have that taken away from me by my husband having an affair or by someone's wife having an affair is such a soul trauma. It's such a betrayal.
Yeah. And it's important to recognize what you're saying right here. It is a betrayal. It doesn't just feel like a betrayal. It is a betrayal.
It's not just subjectively something that I feel, but it's an objective reality, is what you're saying.
Right. I think a lot of the rationalization that goes on by adulterers is, if you're upset by my adultery, speaking to their spouse, if you're upset by my adultery, that's your problem. That's your hang-up. Because I don't mean anything by it. I'm not really betraying you. I don't know why you're feeling betrayed. And that's crazy. Of course you're betraying the person. If we understand how meaningful sexual intimacy is, there's no way we can escape the acknowledgement that we have betrayed them in one of the most treacherous ways possible in human experience. Adultery is treachery. And we just have to face into it and recognize it for what it is.
So, Jack, when we talk about adultery, are we just again talking about sexual intercourse? What exactly is an erotic relationship or an intimate relationship with another person? I think we really need to define that.
Yeah, I think a physical erotic relationship is in the end almost impossible to define in physical terms, because it's ultimately, I think, attitudinal. But let me qualify this right up front, though. We've just talked about the treachery of adultery. There's a kind of flirtation that can go on that is, I would put in the class of a kind of physical adultery, of a kind of erotic intimacy with somebody. Even though there's no physical contact, it's still erotic and it's still adulterous in its intent. When I talk about the treachery of adultery, however, I'm talking about someone going further down the line in their involvement with another person. Flirtation is just as much adulterous morally, but it's not as treacherous. It's not as devastating in its consequences. It's something that can be stopped, can be checked, can be put in perspective, and the two can work it out a lot more easily with a lot less trauma than if someone has actual intercourse with someone else. So there's a matter of degrees in terms of the level of
consequence,
yeah. But if we're going to talk about just the level of the moral quality of it...
You mean the moral wrongness of it.
The moral wrongness of it. A look, a glance across the room can be adulterous, it seems to me. And it fundamentally is not a matter of defining the action, the physical action. A lot of it has to do with what's the spirit in my heart, what's the attitude of my heart, what's the intent of my heart here. Because my actions are manifesting something inside. If my heart is adulterous, my actions are adulterous. If my heart is not adulterous, those very same actions may not be adulterous, or are not adulterous.
You're saying it makes it adulterous depending on what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, where my heart's at when I give that glance. If my heart is just noticing that you're over there and you're talking to my friend and, you know, just something casual, no big deal. But if I notice that you're over there with an intent of drawing attention to me in a sexual way, that's what makes it wrong. And it could be that nobody else besides me will even know what my intent is.
Right.
And God.
Right. Exactly. So the best I can do at defining it is that any physical action that manifests a heart in me given over to desire for physical gratification, or is purposed to elicit that kind of desire for physical gratification in another person. Any action that is ultimately rooted in that is wrong, because the heart is wrong.
Well, I might say to myself, I'm not really looking for physical gratification. I know that I will never have a physical relationship with another person, but I might be looking for some kind of erotic gratification, or good sexual feeling, or a sense of being looked at or important or
right.
viewed by another person.
Yeah, actually, that's what I meant. Thank you. That's a good qualification, because I don't mean it has to be a manifesting a desire to actually have intercourse, for example, but a desire for the gratification that comes from the erotic itself. I may only want the desire, the desire may only be to be desirable to somebody else. And I want that feeling of having someone from a distance even desiring me. But again, why? That's not what sexuality is for. That's inappropriate to just simply want someone to desire me just for the sake of desiring me. The one I should want to desire me is my husband or wife, and that they and they alone. If I understand that about my sexuality, then I am not acting in a way, and I don't have a heart that desires to make other people desire me.
What we're doing, Jack, is really back in the line way, way, way back.
Way back. Yeah.
Way back. I can imagine people saying, oh my heavens, I can't even believe what they're saying. But I really agree with you. It seems to me, and I could be wrong here, but check me out, that intercourse really comes from the same place, the same heart, that a sexual look or a sexual look that wants you to desire me comes from. It's our heart that we're looking at, and the action that comes out of that heart may be different for different people. I might have multiple affairs with one person might have multiple affairs, and another person might just send out all sorts of messages that say, desire me.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them, though, come from a heart that says, that isn't committing myself to be committed to my spouse or to be committed to sexual purity.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Both of them are shining on the principle that sexuality is intended to be this language whereby I communicate the specialness of my spouse and reserve for that and that alone. Both of them are ignoring that and disregarding that completely. And that's what's wrong. We are in rebellion against God. We are hostile to the sexuality that God has given us and the design of that sexuality that God has given us when we decide, no, I get a sort of adrenaline rush when people desire me, and I like that adrenaline rush, and I don't care about right or wrong at all here. I'm going to dress in such a way and stand in such a way and move my body in such a way that I can elicit that response from other men or other women. I want to make them desire me. I want to be desirable because the very idea of being desirable to them gives me a good feeling, gives me a rush.
And Jack, I can imagine people, again, really struggling with what we're saying. Not only for some people because they just won't agree with us because it sounds just too conservative.
Mm-hmm.
For other people, they might agree with us, but have a very big struggle with, oh my heavens, that's a big, huge part of my life. And it is a big, huge part of many, many people's lives. You were talking about it being an adrenaline rush to be desired by another person. And boy, so many people do that. It is such a good drug that works. Drug in the sense that it makes me feel good and it takes me away from what might be painful or difficult in my life. I might be a person that struggles with loneliness or struggles with a very low sense of self-esteem, but I can have people notice me through my sexual prowess, and that has been something that has been a big part of their lives for a very, very long time. Haven't seen it as wrong, have seen it as something that's very important to them, very okay. Our culture very much encourages it. So I can imagine, again, people very much struggling with, oh my heavens, this is going to mean a whole change in my life. And what I would say to that is absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, it does. And beseech God to make this change in your heart, to first recognize that this isn't an okay thing, and to ask Him to help change you. And those people are going to go through a lot of really difficult times. They're going to be feel very deprived, and to the extent that this was used as a drug to distract them from other things that were difficult, boy, they're going to be left in pain. They're going to be left kind of bared to the issues that their sexual prowess has allowed them to avoid.
And it's particularly difficult in the culture in which we live. This is a culture that worships sex. And it's a sex-saturated culture. We have all kinds of sexual erotic images thrown at us all the time, through all the media, through all the people around us, and so on. We're in a position where it seems so normal to be flirtatious and to be sexually oriented that it's hard for people to see that it's wrong if you just take the cues that the society is sending you. And that's where we have to be radically Christian and radically biblical, and just recognize that I don't care what the attitude of my society is towards sex. What is the attitude that it ought to be, that I ought to have towards sex, and take our cues from that rather than take our cues from our peers. Because as long as we're taking our cues from our society, then we're going to be flirtatious, erotically driven people.
Very much so. Very much so. And I know in our lives we really have to watch it all the time, because it's so commonplace that to just do a little thing out of line is so easy. You know, Jack, as we're talking, I'm thinking about my children. And I've got three of them, and they're all growing up. You know, two of them are teenagers, and they're immersed in this. They're saturated in this. We watch television commercials, and, you know, we hear this all the time, but boy, it is so hard to think about how are my kids going to live in this context of sexual purity, in sexual purity in a context of sexual immorality in our culture. What do we do? What do we say to our children? How do we help them? Sometimes I think what we need to do is just put them in a closet.
Yeah.
And close the door. But obviously we can't and wouldn't want to do that. And there's a lot of growing up, I think, that can be done through having to deal with these issues in a responsible way. But how do we as parents help our kids deal with this responsibly? Let's take a break and come back and talk about this.
We don't like to think of ourselves as fools or as being foolish. Although we might entertain the thought while jesting with our close friends or family, being called a fool doesn't sit well with our vulnerable self-images. The Bible, however, makes it abundantly clear that you and I are members in good standing of a class of beings characterized as foolish. That is the opening paragraph of Wes Hurd's News and Views article, What Kind of Fool Are You? In this article, Wes demonstrates how the Bible draws a line between two kinds of fools. Those who are foolish because they disbelieve the gospel, and those who are fools for Christ. To believe the good news of God's salvation for mankind is to believe in something that the world sees as foolish. Believing the gospel often means suffering. It means facing into one's own evil and guilt. It means seeing the death that Christ suffered is a death we all deserve. We might decide to turn from God and seek happiness and success in the world. In God's eyes, this would be true foolishness. So, who are you going to believe? Or more importantly, what kind of fool are you? You can find this article and more at the McKenzie Study Center website, or call and ask for the free copy, 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801.
I was asking you the question, Jack, how do we in such a sexually immoral world help our children be sexually pure, or even want to be, or even see the value of it?
Fundamentally, I don't know, but let me go ahead and make some comments.
It's a hard question.
It's a very hard question. A few comments. First of all, it's very tempting to want to put your kids in the closet. In fact, I think if you were to ask my kids, they would say I did.
How did you do
tried,
that, Jeff?
Or tried to.
We better watch out now. Literally, you didn't do that, right?
No.
Let our listeners be at ease.
You know, but kids are not stupid. So when a sex scene comes on television and you quickly change the channel, you know, you're obviously sending some kind of message to them. And it's very difficult. It makes me angry because the message that the kids could be getting is there's something about sexuality that is wrong, inappropriate, dirty, to be denied, to be avoided, which is not at all the message that I would want to send to my children.
What message do you want to send to your children?
The message I want to send to my children is that sex is sacred. And it has no business being broadcast to millions of people all over the world. Because it's a private matter between two people that belongs between them and them alone. But in that context, it's a beautiful gift that God has given us. It is significant. It is meaningful. It is important. And a glorious communication between two people that are committed to each other. I would want them to know that, but they're not going to know that by being voyeurs looking on to some people who are willing to go public with it or pretend to be doing it on television. Our cultural attitudes are just a tragedy. I would never wish this culture on anybody. This culture should not exist. It's completely wrong. It's thoroughly inappropriate that we would ever be able to find actors and actresses simulate sex the way they do in the movies and on television and so on. It's just wrong. But it's the culture God has put us in. And I think it's impossible and counterproductive to try to take my children out of this culture when I can't. I mean, it would be one thing if it really was a viable option to create a whole different counterculture with different forces, but I'm helpless to do that. I mean, all these forces are coming from every direction, and there's no way in the world that I have the omniscience and the power to stop those forces from coming into my children's life. So it seems to me that the only recourse I have is to do the best I can to communicate wisdom to them so that they can deal wisely with the images that they're getting.
Okay, so let's say that you are watching TV with your children and a sexual scene comes on and you switch the channel. How do you communicate with
that? Let me back up for a second. I would say that I think it's important that I give myself as a parent time to teach that wisdom to my children before they get exposed to all the images that they get exposed to. They need to be ready for those images when they come. And that's the hardest decision in the world to make. You know, when are they old enough? When are they ready? My wife and I engaged in what I think is a whole lot of censorship when our children were younger. All of my impulses want me to continue that censorship, even though my oldest is still in her 20s. I still would like to censor that for her. But I realize she's an adult now. She's got to confront this on her own.
She's got to censor or not censor herself.
Herself, exactly. And I have to remind myself, Jack, you learned to self-censor. You learned to close your eyes at times. You learned to not let images into your brain that you thought would be unhealthy. They can do that. So, and it's their choice, ultimately. Ultimately, they're going to have to choose how important is this to them. So the best I can do is talk about the stuff that we've been talking about in the last several programs. Give them the biblical theory of sexuality. Tell them what it's for. Tell them what it's all about. Give them a vision for not pursuing their sexuality in any other way or in any other context other than to be used as God intended it to be used. Give them that vision. Hopefully it will so capture their imagination that they will own it, make it their own, and live their life in the light of that. If they choose not to, there's really not much I can do about that.
Yeah, bottom line, it really comes down to their choices. And there's so much that we can try and teach our children. But There's no way we can be with them at every point. You were talking about censorship on the TV or movies they watched, or I guess that's what you're talking about,
right,
back when they were younger. I even think about school dances, mm-hmm, and the slow dancing at school dances. I've told my boys, you can't do that. And to the best of my knowledge, and as far as they tell me, they don't do slow dances with their peers. But they may be. I don't really know. It's something that I feel is really, really inappropriate and actually very normal to do in the context of our culture. I try and help them understand what it is, what it means. Right now, I think they could be being obedient to that and maybe understanding it. But, you know, ultimately, I really don't know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a scary thing as a parent to see all this going on and wonder, really, where our children are going to end up.
Yeah, I think the hardest decision as a parent is to know whether now is the time that they're ready to be put in certain pressure situations, or whether now is a time where they still need to be protected from it. I think that's the hardest decision a parent makes. Eventually, they have to face whatever the peer pressure, the temptation, the input, the images. They have to decide themselves, how are they going to respond in the pressured situation. Early in their life, I protect them from the pressure because I know they're not ready for it. I know the pressure is too big for them. So when do you draw the line? When are they ready to go out and confront the world? And when do they need to be sheltered from the world? I don't know. We just bumble through and do the best we can.
We really do bumble through as parents, don't we, Jack?
Yeah.
We try our best, but boy, it's very, very difficult. There's a lot that we can protect our children from when they're young, but there's a lot that we cannot. So you're saying, when do you expose them to the world? Well, ultimately, you can't keep them from being exposed to the world. There's certain things, like asking them not to slow dance or watch or paying attention to the movies they watch or don't watch, those kinds of things. But, you know, I sat in church yesterday and I watched a young girl flirt with a boy in a pretty provocative way in church. Well, that boy's parents were just taking him to church. And so it's out there. It's very prevalent, and our culture says it's very much okay. So we're really up against something very big. Okay, now that we haven't satisfactorily told parents or ourselves exactly how to deal with this, let's go on.
Okay.
What we were saying is that the Bible talks about sexual purity.
So fundamentally, what we've been talking about is the need for sexual faithfulness in the context of a monogamous heterosexual relationship. I mean, that's the biblical vision for sexuality. But the thing that we have to keep in mind, and that's what we've been exploring, is that there are more ways of committing adultery physically, erotically, other than just simply normal intercourse. There's all kinds of alternative erotic behaviors and a manifestation of erotic desires that can come out in words, in looks, in glances, in all kinds of different ways that are just a manifestation of my desire to experience the erotic. And all of that, what we've been contending, is ultimately adulterous. It's morally equivalent to having sexual intercourse with somebody else. It is the moral equivalent. We've talked about this in the past, but there's also another form of adultery that is not really even erotic necessarily. It may not involve the erotic at all, and that's what I think in the past we've called emotional adultery. We don't need to explore that at length here because we have in previous programs, but I think we just need to keep in mind that if I marry myself to another person, even though I'm legally married to my wife or husband, but at an emotional level, my real commitments get shifted over to another person, never mind that there's nothing erotic that ever goes on. I have divorced the one and married another, as far as my emotional commitments are concerned. And that's wrong, because my marriage vows were to be committed for life to my wife or husband.
Well, let's go into this just a tiny bit more.
Okay.
Some of the emotional commitments that I can have to other people, or some of the other people I can have emotional commitments to, are my children, mm-hmm. over and above my spouse, of my family, my parents, my brothers, my sisters. Although that there's quite a loyalty among family oftentimes or sometimes, even that is wrong if it's over and above my commitment to my spouse.
Right.
I could have a commitment to a very, very good friend who...
Of the same sex.
Of the same sex or of the opposite sex, mm-hmm. who cares about me, who values me, who thinks I'm important, and over time, eventually, that can become where I have my loyalty, where it becomes more important to me, that person's welfare, than the welfare of my spouse, or my relationship with that person over the welfare, or my relationship with my spouse. So it can come from almost any place, but we need to just be really careful to keep in front of ourselves that what's important is my spouse, what I've committed to is my spouse.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the two of those combined, the physical adultery that happens when I am either making intimate physical contact, erotic contact, or no contact, but I am experiencing an erotic energy between me and somebody else, and owning that and encouraging that or instilling that in another, that's physically adulterous. And then emotional adultery is this shifting of loyalty and shifting of allegiance to anybody else other than my spouse. That's the adultery that the Bible speaks of as being so wrong and so treacherous ultimately.
Jack, before we go on, what if we back up to looking at some examples of what is physical adultery, what is emotional adultery in a little bit more detail, because it's such a difficult part of people's lives and it interfaces with so many areas of our lives. I'm thinking of a woman going to work and wanting to move ahead, and seeing that in order to move ahead, she has to be a little bit sexual with her boss. She has to at least play in the rules of the game that say, be appealing. What would you say to a woman like that, who's really wanting to have sexual purity, and yet seeing that in order to keep her job, just to maintain it or to move ahead, there has to be a little bit of eroticism?
Well, I think she would just have to face into the fact that it's wrong. It's utilizing her sexuality for something that God never intended her sexuality to be used for. Job advancement, job placement, giving somebody else an inappropriate pleasure, fulfilling an inappropriate desire in someone else in order for life to go better for me. It's a compromise. I'm compromising myself. And I cannot and should not do that if I'm really serious about my discipleship to Jesus.
So I'll be that woman for a minute and just kind of role play it. Well, Jack, you know, that's really easy for you to say, but you're not raising two children on your own, and I need to have an income. And if I don't play the rules of the game, I'm not in the game, and I basically can't support my children.
Okay.
Would God have me not do that?
Okay, but with that line of reasoning, where do we stop? I mean, would prostitution be a profitable way of supporting children? Economically, maybe, but haven't we crossed a line there? So we all recognize that there's a line you can cross where even the very noble goal of supporting my children does not justify me crossing that line. The question is, where is that line? And what I'm arguing is that line needs to be moved back to the point where I don't even dress provocatively. I practice the biblical virtue of modesty. I don't dress provocatively. I don't carry myself provocatively. I don't play with my sexuality because it's wrong. And to cross that line, it's not appropriate to cross that line in order to raise a family. There comes a point where we have to trust God that I can raise my family and support my family and provide for my family without compromising my integrity and without transgressing God's own will. If God's not going to take care of me, then who is?
When you say trust God, you wouldn't necessarily say to this woman that we're role-playing here that she would even necessarily be able to have the same income.
Right, she may not.
She may not. She may be in poverty.
Right.
So you're not saying trust God for the same amount of money a month, but trust God What do you mean by that?
Yeah. The beautiful image that the Bible gives us of the kind of thing that I'm talking about is Joseph, when he was approached by Potiphar's wife who wanted to have sex with him. And Joseph fled. You know, she grabbed hold of his garment. He fled and left the garment behind. Potiphar's wife then used that garment to accuse him wrongly of attempting to either rape or seduce her, I don't remember which, and he was thrown in prison. But he was willing to go to prison for, I can't remember how many years, in order to protect his sexual integrity. It seems to me that that's the kind of commitment to sexual purity and sexual integrity that we need to have. If it means a lower income, if it means going to prison for a few years, if it means any number of sacrifices, nevertheless, it's worth it. Because this is about my soul. This is about my integrity. This is about my basic fundamental commitments of my life. What are those all about? Those are going to be eternal. Those I'm going to take with me into the kingdom of God. Those are the most important things I've got in this life. And it's well worth sacrificing things of this world, financial things, in order to keep my integrity intact.
Over the years, a lot of people have come through Mackenzie Study Center. Some have come to study biblical interpretation. Some come to focus on applying the truth of the Bible to the world we live in. And others come for the great Bible teaching. And still others come because they need a place to think about their faith. What is Mackenzie? It's a group of people who take the Bible seriously, who see the goal of this life as the pursuit of righteousness and wisdom, who see the gospel as the most profound message in all of human history. The Mackenzie staff members have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of knowing the truth contained in the Bible. They see the need to get back to the Bible as more important than ever in this darkening world. Getting back to the Bible means trying to understand what the biblical authors intended to say when they wrote the Bible. And this can be hard work. The scriptures are often difficult to interpret and understand. Sometimes the Bible doesn't always say what we want it to say. But if we are to come to understand this world and our place in it from God's perspective, then the hard work of biblical interpretation is worth it. This is the passion motivating the staff and families of Mackenzie Study Center. If you are interested in knowing more about Mackenzie, we'll give you information on how to contact us at the end of the program. And when you do, you might ask for some of our News and Views articles, such as Forgiveness, The Parable of the Unforgiving Servant by Ron Julian. In this article, Ron takes a close look at Christ's statement that if we don't forgive, we will not be forgiven. Ron's conclusion is that Christ meant exactly what he said. God's people know that they are sinners, and only the mercy of God stands between them and their deserved destruction. It is this humility, without which no one can come to the cross of Christ, which results in forgiving others. Ron argues that Jesus makes this point most forcefully in the parable of the unforgiving servant. Or you might want to read Jack Crabtree's Believing Without Seeing, First Reflections on Thomas. In this article, Jack argues that doubting Thomas has received a bum rap. Thomas merely demanded the same evidence of God's resurrection that the other disciples had received. Jack states, in the unfolding of the historical events, Thomas and no one else explicitly articulates what evidence he requires in order to believe. Jack goes on to say that this story highlights the extraordinary hurdle that exists for most people, for people like you and me, to come to believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Then he personally concludes, I believe in the resurrection of Jesus, most importantly, because it makes so much sense in the light of everything I have come to understand and know about myself, about God, and about life in general. Again, at the end of the program, we'll give you information on how you can find out more about Mackenzie Study Center.
Jack, what struck me most about what we've said in this last hour is that what God is looking at, again, is our hearts. When we try and set up a structure of what's right and what's wrong, should I do this, should I do that sexually, what's good, what's bad, it's very, very difficult to do that because a glance, a handhold, a kiss on the cheek can be a very okay thing to do with another person. And it may not be. It really depends on where it's coming from. Is our intent to allure another person, to make them desire us, to be attracted to us? Or is it our intent to extend a friendly welcome or a friendly greeting to them? Nobody else can know that except ourselves and God. And sometimes not even ourselves. Sometimes we can fool ourselves into thinking that what we're doing is okay because we allow ourselves to be kind of lured in by the society that we're around. I'm very struck by the need, Jack, to be very, very aware of looking at and evaluating our own sexual response to other people, our own hearts, our own actions toward other people, in light of this biblical imperative to have sexual purity. And it seems like what sexual purity is at its bottom is loving another person.
Yes, it's a commitment to see other people, as human creatures like I am, made in the image of God to be loved rather than objects of physical gratification and sexual energy. It just, there's two very different ways of looking at people, and I think you've nailed it, that to the extent that we see them as simply a foil for my sexual energy, then I am not looking at them the way I need to be looking at them. They are people made in the image of God that need to be respected as such and loved accordingly.
That is a radical, we could say, ideal. But I would like to take it from an ideal, Jack, to a reality. I'd like to continue to make that a reality in my life and encourage other people to, along with you and I, to say this really is important. Loving people really is the bottom line of what we need to be doing with our lives. So let's work for it. Let's try for it. Let's know that we're going to fail. We're going to fail a lot. For some of us, it will be much more difficult because we have a pattern in our lives of being sexually alluring or being casual in the use of our sexuality. Well, let's say that it's important not to be that way and to head in a new direction. It's right to do that, and it's loving to do that. It's right because God says it's right, and it's right because God made our psyche to need and to want to be valued, not to be used.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a non-profit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.